Case number 19-3045, United States of America versus Manuel D. Reynoso, appellant. Mr. Mammon for the appellant, Mr. Goodhand for the appellee.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. Mammon, when you're ready, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I am Nathan Mammon, appearing on behalf of Manuel Reynoso. While our briefs identify multiple errors that occurred in Mr. Reynoso's case, I'd like today to focus on two issues that we submit require a new trial. First, that the district court failed to instruct the jury that it must find Reynoso knew he had the status of having been convicted of a crime punishable by more than a year in prison. And second, that the district court erred by allowing a key defense witness, Val Rodriguez, to refuse to provide testimony for Reynoso in violation of Mr. Reynoso's Sixth Amendment right. First, the jury was not instructed
to increase the volume a little bit for Mr. Mammon.
Sorry.
Thank you.
The jury was not instructed that it must find Reynoso knew he could not possess a firearm, as the Supreme Court held was required in Rehoff versus United States in 2019. Now, Rehoff was decided after Mr. Reynoso's trial, and plain error review applies here. The government does not dispute that the first three prongs of plain error review are met. The only question before the court is whether the court should recognize and grant relief for the error that it affects the fairness of the proceeding. And we submit it does. This case is different in one key respect from nearly all the cases that the government cites where the courts concluded the Rehoff error did not affect the fairness of the trial.
Before you get to the difference, all the cases the government cites, other circuits have decided there did have to be a showing of prejudice, essentially, didn't they?
Other circuits have held in the published decisions, there's actually, right in the time of the reply brief, a Second Circuit unpublished decision that found that there was, similar to these facts, that there was not prejudice, or there was no showing that the defendant would have known. But the other cases that are cited in the briefs, the courts of appeals have said that there must be some showing or needs to be some evidence that the defendant will look at the record and see if the defendant should have known that he had been serving or had been convicted of a crime carrying more than a year in prison.
Yeah.
But in those cases, I think the key fact from those cases is that in all those cases, except one that I'm aware of, the defendant actually had served multiple years in prison.
Here the defendant had been sentenced to 2 5-year terms, had he not?
Two essentially 5-year terms. He had been sentenced, both, one was suspended entirely, one was suspended to be less than a year, so he served some months in prison.
But he was sentenced, he was in court and sentenced to more than a year. It was suspended, but he was in fact sentenced to more than a year, right?
He did receive a sentence, a suspended sentence, but a sentence to more than a year. But we don't have in this case, which also happens in other cases, that where there's evidence of what was said at the plea colloquy, what was required before the court, the state courts could accept the guilty plea.
We know that a judgment was entered of more than a year sentence. Right.
We do know that a judgment was entered of more than a year, but again, part of the sentence or the majority of the sentence was suspended.
Thank you.
But we don't know, what was told to Mr. Reynoso, what he was instructed as far as accepting the guilty plea, that he understood the ramifications. Again, facts that if the court looks at the other courts of appeals, those are facts that the other courts of appeals found significant in not recognizing the Rehoff error, the plain error of Rehoff. And so we submit on this record where we don't know, we know that he didn't serve more than a year in prison. We don't have any evidence from any plea colloquies, any other statements on the record to indicate that Mr. Reynoso knew he had been convicted of a crime that carried a sentence more than a year when he practically had not spent a year in jail. That this record does not conclusively show that he knew his status was such that he could not possess the firearm.
So can I ask you a question about this? I know you have your other issue you want to talk about too, but on this one, you framed it in part as a plain error question along the lines of what you just articulated. And then you also have a sufficiency claim that's
correct.
Associated with this. And on the sufficiency claim, it just seems a little bit odd to be talking about sufficiency when we're talking about an element that wasn't instructed to begin with, because nobody even knew that it was an element at the time. At least nobody involved in this case knew it was an element at the time. And so the Ninth Circuit has a decision that indicates that we don't think of that issue as a sufficiency issue, because we base sufficiency analysis on the elements that were in fact given to the jury, and we ask whether the jury had sufficient evidence from which to find that the element was met. Here you just can't even do that, because nobody understood that Rahafe was going to come down and require a finding by the jury of knowledge of felon status.
You know, I understand, I agree, and I think the sufficiency point ties in with the Rehaf error point of that there was no evidence. If you look at the jury, if the court is constrained by what was the jury record, the trial record. So I know courts of appeals have, for the most part, concluded you could look beyond
right. The
record before the jury. But if you're constrained by what the record before the jury in determining whether you could conclude that he would have known of his status, that record, it's part of the plain error analysis as well, that there's insufficient evidence to conclude on that record that he would have known.
Right. So I think, I take your point that, you know, you would have a stronger argument if you're bound by the record that was submitted as opposed to whether you could look beyond the record. And let's just suppose, I know you disagree with this, but let's suppose for plain error purposes, we think you can look beyond the record and you can look to what the facts are in the world. And then for plain error purposes, that means you take into account some things that the jury wasn't confronted with. But for sufficiency purposes, you still couldn't do that. And then so you'd have your sufficiency claim, but in theory, but in fact, the sufficiency analysis seems like a mismatch here when you don't have a jury instructed on the element to begin with. Then it seems like you're back to plain error, and you have your arguments on plain error. I'm not suggesting that you necessarily win or lose on those. I'm just wondering whether there's in fact a freestanding sufficiency claim that would give you the certainty of limiting things to the record presented to the jury, when here we're not even really talking about the normal sufficiency rubric because the element was just never given to the jury.
I think they dovetail together at some point,
okay.
And it comes down to the sufficiency, to my point, the sufficiency claim. If the court is constrained by the record before the jury, I don't know if it matters whether it's under plain error review or sufficiency, but it's an added sort of wrinkle on that question of, you know, what the record, whether the court can conclude that there was evidence beyond a reasonable doubt based on the evidence before the jury. That he knew of his status.
Got it. So the way it sounds like the way you're conceiving the sufficiency claim is it's piggybacking on the plain error claim, assuming that for plain error purposes, you're constrained to the record that was presented to the jury.
Yeah, sure. That's a much better way of phrasing it. Thank you.
Thank you for that clarification.
If I could just say one quick minute on the Sixth Amendment issue, there was a witness, Val Rodriguez, who was undisputedly the key witness in this case, because I don't think there's any dispute that it was his gun. That he placed it in the car, and that he didn't tell Mr. Reynoso that he placed it in the car.
What do you see as the effect of the stipulation below as to what the testimony would have been from Rodriguez?
Well, the effect of the stipulation is Mr. Reynoso...
Has this error, if any, been waived or forfeited by that?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe that the error has been waived or forfeited because Mr. Reynoso made clear multiple times that he intended to call. He subpoenaed Mr. Rodriguez, the district court, and made clear that was pressuring or encouraging the parties to reach a stipulation. And the key parts come at page 708, 709, 710 of the joint appendix, where the district court said, look, I think he's clearly going to assert the Fifth. I think he has Fifth Amendment issues with Mr. Rodriguez, Fifth Amendment issues with respect to cross-examination questions. And then posed it as, well, maybe you could get this evidence in through hearsay exception through testimony of the law enforcement officers. And at that point, Mr. Reynoso's trial counsel was left with really no choice of he could put all his eggs in the appellate basket and say, no, I want to call him. And the district court can refuse and conclude that Rodriguez could assert his privilege. Or he could accept the half loaf that he was offered at that time to stipulating to this testimony. And so I also believe that in the context of how this came about, Mr. Reynoso certainly didn't say he was waiving his rights to challenge this issue. And in the context of how this came about, I don't believe that it clearly indicates that he had an affirmative waiver of this claim.
So just one question on that issue. There is this point at 720 of the joint appendix where the witness's counsel said, I just want to confirm with the court that it's all right for the witness to be excused and for me to be excused at this point. And your client's counsel said, it's fine with the defense, Your Honor. Doesn't it seem like the defense counsel is saying that now that we have the stipulation, I'm fine with the defense, as the counsel put it, for the witness to be excused?
Your Honor, certainly it would be nice if we could have a clear objection on this point. But I think, again, if the court looks at the context of how this came about, by that time, it was understood that Rodriguez would take the stand, assert his Fifth Amendment privilege. They'd agreed to a stipulation Fifth Amendment privilege, and presumably he wouldn't testify. Law enforcement officers would testify. They agreed to a stipulation that would cover what the law enforcement officers would relay. And at that point, as Mr. Renez's trial counsel said, look, I don't have any, there's no purpose of bringing him to the stand just to assert the right.
He might have been able to have, if he asserted the right, then there would have been an argument for admissible hearsay, would there not? At least an argument.
That certainly was a discussion throughout. Mm-hmm. The government opposed that and said that.
Now you were not hearsay. Trial counsel, right?
I was not trial counsel.
Right. Good.
Thank you, Your Honor. If no further questions, we'd ask that the court vacate and remand for a new trial.
Thank you. We'll give you your time for rebuttal that you requested too, Mr. Mammon. Thank you. We'll hear from the government now, Mr. Goodhand.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, David Goodhand for the United States. Taking the issues raised by the defendant in reverse order, turning first to the Fifth Amendment claim, the government believes the record demonstrates a waiver here. This was a knowing waiver. It was a voluntary waiver. Turning first to the question of voluntary, I know my opponent has suggested the district court insisted that he accept the stipulation. The record bespeaks the opposite. The district court twice asked, emphasis on asked, if the parties had talked about a stipulation. The defendant twice indicated he would be, quote, glad to, close quote, to consider a stipulation. And then the defendant even set the terms of the stipulation by articulating the material facts that he wanted in the stipulation. And then this is at JA 710, excuse me, said, as long as we are able to get that information before the jury, we would be fine. And then the court adjourned the proceedings so the parties could discuss this. The parties came back and the defendant declared, we do have an agreement in principle about a stipulation. That's at JA 717. So that's sort of the voluntary prong of waiver. The knowing prong that I know, again, my opponent has suggested was missing here. I think he has phrased it as the stipulation wasn't necessarily conditioned on a waiver of testimony. And again, the government would submit that the record bespeaks the opposite. In particular, at JA 708, the court asks, have you conferred, this is a quote, have you conferred about a stipulation as opposed to testimony, close quote. The court also asked, in order to avoid the appellate issue, have you conferred about a stipulation? Those are both at JA 708. So to the extent that there's knowledge about both, I'm taking the stipulation in lieu of testimony, that's answered by the JA 708 site. There's also even an indication that the defendant should have understood that he couldn't be doing what he's doing now, which is raising a series of claims relating to decisions and inquiries that the district court never had to make because of the stipulation. That is, to avoid the appellate issue, the court said, have you talked about a stipulation? And the defendant agreed to that. I would suggest, you know, look, we don't lightly invoke waiver. We understand that means that court that cuts off this court's consideration of the error as opposed to a forfeited claim. So we don't lightly go down this road, but I would suggest this is a good case for adhering to the waiver and enforcing it, because the defendant, by all accounts, Mr. Rodriguez was actually in the courthouse. He was apparently in the hallway, and the defendant never pursued whether or not he was indeed invoking. He never pursued a question by a question inquiry about the scope of the privilege that, assuming it was invoked. He never asked the court to do the waiver analysis once that had been discussed. And finally, he never, of course, asked the court to conduct the Pardo balancing, which he says was erroneous. So again, what we have here is, this is why you have waiver. The defendant struck a pretty good bargain with the government. The government gave up its cross-examination rights. He got in the statements of Rodriguez and he put them before the jury in his closing argument. So in that respect, we think this is a good vehicle for enforcing the waiver that we have here, which was both knowing and voluntary.
So there's before you go to your second issue, just have one question on this. There's nothing conceptually implausible about both taking the stipulation and also continuing to want to the witness to testify, right? I mean, in theory, a defense counsel could certainly do that. They could say, look, I get it. I mean, it sounds to me like I may not get this testimony. So sure, I'll take the stipulation because that's all I can get. But I just want to make sure that everybody understands I'd rather have the witness.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think I don't disagree with that for one moment, but what we have here is not that caveat. What we have here is the district court saying, we could resolve this with a stipulation as opposed to testimony. And the defendant agreeing to that, and as the site that was raised when my opponent was at the podium, the defendant actually agreed to release the witness. So I don't disagree with the notion there's not an internal conflict there, but on this record, what we have is a fairly significant, robust waiver.
Okay.
Turning to the Rahafe issue, a couple things first before I get into my argument. I would note that in the reply brief, the defendant has cited on several occasions the Fourth Circuit's decision in Medley. I just wanted to make sure that the court understood that on November 12th, the Fourth Circuit vacated that decision, and they are now granted en banc review of the Medley decision. So a lot of the arguments relating to Rahafe in the context of, you know, what kind of error was this? What prong of Olano do you access? The only authority that he has for a lot of these arguments is now rests on a vacated Fourth Circuit opinion, number one. Number two, as to the instructional error, certainly it's the defendant's burden to demonstrate that this, by not recognizing the error, this would undermine the integrity and the public reputation of the judicial proceedings. As numerous courts have indicated, quite the opposite would be true if you were to recognize the error in a case like this. Old Chief constrains the government before Rahafe. That is, the government could not put in evidence relating to the depth and the details and the nature of a prior conviction. So the government, of course, held its hand in this case before Rahafe based on Old Chief. Now to come back around and suggest, well, the government didn't put into the record the requisite information, well, that would undermine the government submits the public reputation of proceedings. And of course, this is easily resolved by just simply looking at the PSR here, where the defendant, 3 months before he was stopped on 17th Street, pled guilty to being a felon in possession in Maryland State Court. So the suggestion that there's somehow a miscarriage of justice because he didn't understand his status, I would suggest, is belied by both the prior plea to being a felon in possession, coupled with, of course, in 2011, he was sentenced to 2 5-year terms. I don't have any further.
I have a question for you on this, sure. Which is related to the question I asked Mr. Mammon. So opening brief frames a related sufficiency challenge on this score. And the government didn't respond by saying that there's no such thing as a sufficiency challenge in this context. And first, I'm wondering why, because it's not clear to me that a sufficiency challenge makes sense where you have a jury that was never instructed on an element. And second, if you think that there is the possibility of a sufficiency challenge, I'm not sure I understand how the evidence could be deemed sufficient here, because there was just no evidence introduced at trial about his knowledge.
Turning to Your Honor's second point first, the several courts have been comfortable with the notion that the stipulation alone, if you're in the context of sufficiency, the only question is whether any reasonable juror could conclude that he had knowledge of his status. And at least a couple courts have concluded that the stipulation itself would permit a reasonable juror to conclude that he had knowledge of his status. That is, he stipulated to the fact that he was indeed someone who had been convicted of a crime and been imprisoned by more than 1 year.
I get that, but that would just mean that then Rahafe means nothing, because the whole point of Rahafe, at least in the felon context, I understand that case came up with one of the other disabling statuses, but there's a difference between being a felon and knowing you're a felon. That's the premise of the entire decision.
Sure.
So what the stipulation tells you is that you were a felon. It doesn't tell you that the person knew that they were a felon. Now, I take the point that most people, when they have a felony conviction, we can reliably assume that they know that they have a felony conviction. I understand that. But usually that's proved somehow. There's evidence submitted that at least somebody testifies, or there's something that comes up that says, look, and people know they have a felony conviction, right? Yes. But there's got to be some evidence that goes to that point, as opposed to the mere fact of having been a felon. Otherwise, that element, the whole point of Rahafe in the felon context, just goes away.
I actually disagree with the court's suggestion, to the extent that, again, we're in the sufficiency context.
Yeah.
That's the template. Then the question becomes, is this a reasonable inference, or is it based purely on speculation? And the question is, and the courts have said this, I'm sorry, I see my time's up.
That's all right, you can go.
The courts have said, it is a reasonable inference from the admission that you are indeed a person who has been convicted of a crime that is a felony. It's a reasonable inference for a jury to conclude from that alone that you would be a person who would know about that. It's an earth-shattering notion that you would be a person who had been convicted of a felony and not know it.
So do you think that it's a separate element to show that the defendant knew that he was a felon than that he in fact was a felon?
Yes.
Then in this case, for example, when the stipulation's made about felon status, the jury's given the instruction that the evidence is relevant only to proving that the defendant was unlawfully in possession of a firearm as a person previously convicted of a crime punishable by imprisonment for a term exceeding 1 year. So the jury specifically told, you can only take this stipulation for purposes of felon status. It's not given the option of taking that into account for purposes of the mens rea. Now, at the time, nobody knew that you even cared about that. I understand
right.
that, but that seems
right.
to go back to the question of whether there's such a thing as a sufficiency challenge in this context. But
when
the jury specifically told you can't take it into account for any other purpose, I don't know how we can say that it goes to sufficiency.
Well, I understand. And of course, it is difficult to analyze this on the back end when Rahafe comes down in the interim. And of course, that instruction. I would note this, however, we also pointed to the evasive conduct that the defendant signaled on the scene. And again,
right. I understand that. I mean, and there's other evidence that you could in theory point to. I mean, it's not the strongest evidence of knowledge of felon status. There's much more that directly could have been done, but everybody, I take the point that everybody's operating on a false premise here, because nobody knew that you needed evidence. It's not as if the government couldn't come up with something that would have been completely satisfying had they known.
Right.
It's just that we're operating in this strange world in which nobody even knew that this mattered.
And I'll finish with this note. I'm over my time, but that circles back around to the core question that relating to the fourth prong of Olano, which is, are you doing a disservice to the public reputation of a judicial proceeding if you do not recognize the error? And I would suggest, as many courts have found, the disservice would be done if you reversed here.
Right. For plain error purposes, that might totally take the point. It gets confusing with sufficiency, but I think we've been around that. But we appreciate your arguments. If my colleagues don't have any further questions for you.
No questions.
No. Okay.
Thank you. We would ask that you affirm the conviction below. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mammon, we'll give you your 2 minutes of rebuttal that you'd asked for.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could start back with the Rehoff issue, and my colleague on the other side mentioned the Maryland offense and using that as further evidence that he would have known as a felony status. First, we don't actually know, and at the time that he was arrested and found with this firearm in his car, he had been pled guilty but hadn't been sentenced yet in Maryland. There's a paucity of information on what that Maryland offense was about. There's nothing that was put in the record. I've gone back and tried to figure out the offense that he would have pled guilty to and the nature of it. We don't know the plea colloquy, but I can say based on my research that Maryland, again, this is that 922 doesn't require you be convicted of a felony. 922 says you have to know your status, that you've been convicted of a crime carrying a sentence of more than a year of imprisonment. Yep. The Maryland offense that I think applies here is one that requires a felony conviction that could be under a state law felony, which can be, you know, include drug crimes, include the breadth of it, I guess, is unknown, that it's not coextensive of knowledge and pleading guilty to knowledge you've been convicted of a felony, which he had in the Virginia state for, transfers over to, well, you also knew that you'd convicted of a crime that carried a more than a year in prison when he never served a more than a year in prison. So I think that's, I think the Maryland plea was never relied on below, but it's also, you know, doesn't get us there as far as proof that Mr. Reynoso knew of his status. Regarding the medley, Macaulay points out, yes, Fourth Circuit is hearing medley in bank, I believe in January. But even on medley's facts, this case is much, much different. Medley spent 16 years in prison. And so, you know, there's that fact that aligns with all the other circuits, which have looked at the length of time that a person actually spends in prison and saying, well, surely they know they were convicted of offense, carried more than a year of prison when they served that. Thank you, Your Honor, for time. If you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer them, but I see my time has expired.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. And Mr. Mammon, you were appointed by the court to assist us in this matter, and the court appreciates your able assistance.